Okay. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. This is not on my script, but I would like to wish everybody a happy Valentine's Day. Let the record reflect that the time now is currently 1:34 p.m. on Tuesday, February 14th, 2017. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Wilson, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Guerra, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Gren, Representative Guttenberg, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Representative Thompson is running a little late. He does have a bill up in another committee. Before we start, reminder, just please mute your cell phones. And for the presenters, please do not use acronyms. And on today's schedule, we're going to be taking up questions on HB 115, the income tax, PFD credit, and permanent fund income bill. And available today, we have a number of people here. John Hutchins from the Department of Law, Angela Rodell, Executive Director of the Permanent Fund Corporation. And on the phone, we have Carl Davis from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Additionally, we have Ken Alper, Director of the Tax Division, Department of Revenue. He's here, and he'll walk us through the department's fiscal note. And first, I'd like to call John Hutchins from the Department of Law to the table. And Mr. Hutchins, if you're here, if you could please put yourself on the record and start with your presentation. Thanks for being here.
Hi, this is John Hutchins from the Department of Law. I actually didn't have a presentation. I was just available for questions. So
we're really okay with folks making up impromptu presentations. So great. No, I'm just kidding. But we did have a number of questions for the Department of Law yesterday, and so I see we've got two to my left here, Representative Kawasaki and then Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being here, Mr. Hutchins. There was a previous broadcast, members of the other body were commenting on the single subject rule and whether the single subject rule applied to this particular bill. I'd like to just hear your comments from on behalf of Department of Law.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. The test in the single subject rule is not whether you can have find two analytically distinct subjects that are covered by the same bill. It's very clear from existing Alaska case law that that's not true. For example, in Gellert, the court was looking at a bill that combined small boat harbors and coastal cities and a flood control projects in Fairbanks, and Fairbanks is not particularly close to the coast, so it's pretty easy to say there are two separate subjects there, but the court found that it was a single subject. It was water navigation, water control. So the only question is, questions are whether there is a subject that will cover everything in the bill and whether it's too broad. And I think I'm highly confident that this bill would pass scrutiny under that test for a variety of reasons that I can go into in some depth if you would like. First, if you look at the purpose of the single subject rule, the purpose is to prevent tactical use of the committee structure. So the court itself has said that one of the primary things that the single subject rule is trying to avoid is combining a bunch of different constituencies to pass legislation that otherwise couldn't pass on its own. With this bill, you can perhaps analytically divide it into a permanent fund component and an income tax component, but the reason for including both of those in the same bill is not because neither of them would pass on their own. In fact, if you were looking at them individually, neither is the sort of thing that you would say is a popular measure that is going to pull a weaker bill along. They're both kind of millstones that you would use to sink a measure rather than the other way around. So there's very limited concern there. But more importantly, they're both common solutions to one problem, or they're both part of a solution to one problem, and they're interrelated. What you do on one affects the desirability of what you do on the other, or even what you can do on the other while reaching the same revenue requirement. So it makes a lot of sense to talk about them, debate about them, consider amendments to them in the same bill at the same time, because you're addressing really one problem, and that's the budget. So for that reason, I would be stunned, really, if a court looking at this decided that this did not meet a single subject, or that the subject was too broad. It's just clear that this bill is could efficiently be looked at unless you looked at both pieces at the same time. Is there anything more?
Okay. We've got a question from Representative. We did have a question. Any other questions? Seeing no questions, thank you, Mr. Hutchins. Angela Rodell is here. She's the Executive Director of the Permanent Fund Corporation. If she could please come up, and we'll see if we've got any questions for her. Ms. Rodell, if you could put yourself on the record, and if you've got any opening statements, feel free to jump right in. Otherwise, we can just ask questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and I'm available to answer questions you may have about how this bill works with the corporation and the fund, or to not answer any questions if the committee doesn't have any.
Real good. Do we have any questions? We've got a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill has a 4.75% of market value draw from the fund. Does that level of draw from the fund, to you, place the fund in any risk of being depleted?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I think it's really important for the committee and members of the legislature to understand that the Board of Trustees does not want us to take any position on the bill in terms of what the appropriate draw amount is. I think when we look at what the decisions that the committee and other members of the legislature are facing, that we recognize that it's going to be a give and take, and that you'll ultimately decide on what's best for the state, and we will respond accordingly. 4.75% is a draw, which generates a certain amount of money to the budget, and we will deliver that amount if that is how the bill ultimately ends up.
Follow up. I guess the only other section of the bill that really involves the permanent fund is a distribution of that draw, 33% of it flowing to the distribution fund for the dividend, and 67% of it flowing to the general fund. Is that in any way an obstacle for the permanent fund to be able to calculate and make that draw distributed to two different funds?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, no, because I think in practice what will happen is that we will remit one transfer of cash over to the Department of Revenue, and Department of Revenue will then allocate it between the two accounts within that it manages. So it will move it into the dividend fund because they hold the dividend fund over at the Department of Revenue, and then they'll move the 67% into the unrestricted general fund accounts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there any further questions, Representative Guttenberg, and then Kawasaki, and then Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have, I'm sure you've seen, well, I hope you've seen them, or various flowcharts of the permanent fund. We have one where how it works now, the current system, then the restructuring, but over the years there's been lots of different proposals, and it's not like when we're going to a percent of market value for the it's not all one lump sum of cash. It's different pots of money moving in and being calculated for coming up with something. Just as far as the, and maybe it's not even true of the permanent fund now, but it's how you invest, the philosophy of how you invest the different funds. Is the proposal in 115 the, if you were to take the permanent fund and invest it for a percent of market value, how similar would you be to what's laid out in 115, House Bill 115, in order to maximize the return?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I think it's important to take a step back and remember that we have a first and then a second legislative finding and mandate in how we invest the fund. And the first one is to protect principal, and the second one is to maximize income. And they can be competing objectives, because obviously in order to maximize growth, you have a tendency to take more risk, but taking more risk can jeopardize that protection of principal. So we've worked really hard to create a diverse asset allocation that balances those two competing requirements for us. When we look at the provisions of House Bill 115, what we are focused on is that the draw is equal to 4.75% of the market value, and what type of liquidity that is going to require each fiscal year. I think the point is that because this is five of the previous 6 years, there will be dollar amount certainty on the draw amount. In other words, right now, the way we currently have it in statute to move money over for the dividend is that we do an estimated amount for what our statutory net income will be for the fiscal year that we're in. We're moving that uncertainty from this calculation and looking at the previous 5 years. And so the benefit, I think, to this body will be that you will walk in on the first day of session knowing what one of your revenue streams is for certain for the upcoming fiscal year as you're doing the budget discussions. So in terms of managing the investments, currently we don't foresee a needed change to the asset allocation and investment management. The challenge for us will be as these programs mature, whether or not the asset allocation of the earnings reserve account needs to be adjusted into a different asset allocation that more fully recognizes the inability of that account to perhaps take on the risk that the corpus takes today, that it takes with the corpus today, because it can't afford to lose at all.
All right. If I may, Mr. Chair, just follow up. Thank you. You know, when we've gone through this exercise before, and I know I surprised some people the last time we had a vote under Governor Murkowski, and I voted yes for his constitutional amendment to create a POMV. So I'm trying to judge, and we've had over the years a lot of conversations and presentations on the endowments and how they work around the world, because this is not unique, but this is unique for us. Are they set up? I mean, they do a POMV, they do a percent of market value, but we're setting up a fixed rate of draw off of there. Do other nations do a fixed rate draw or a percentage of what's made on a yearly rate, on a yearly basis, or five of the past 6 years, how we're talking about it here? What is the usual definition of how much money you take off a sovereign fund like this? Considering you're going to be doing, maybe you're going to do inflation proofing, maybe you're not, what the purpose is, but can you comment on that?
I'd be happy to, through the chair. I think one of the important distinctions to note, even between the constitutional amendment from, I guess that was 2003, 2004, roughly that time frame, and what other sovereign wealth funds are able to do, is that our constitutional amendment requires that all income go to the general fund. And that's what's sort of creating these machinations we have today, because the way traditional POMV processes work is that you look at the value of the fund, you take a percentage of the market value, and that becomes your spend, and you don't have any reference to realized and unrealized earnings or income or anything. It's based fully on that value, and that's why there was why the Board of Trustees was so enthusiastic in their support for the constitutional amendment, because it cleaned up all that income language and made it very straightforward that every year we would transfer over a set percentage, and you didn't have to worry about inflation proofing anymore. You didn't have to worry about income because all of it was now just one big pot. Here we sit in 2017, and we have this requirement that income moves to the general fund. And so we're trying to make something work within the language that we're required to operate in. If you look at other sovereign wealth funds and endowments, I saw a survey recently where the last, in 2016, the average payout on endowments was 4.3%. But remember, they're getting to take it without regard to what actual income is, because all of that income gets plowed back into the fund and invested. And so that's the difference here. Here, the income is flowing into another account that is available to be appropriated in its entirety, regardless of what rules you have in place, and you're deciding how much of that you want to spend on an annual basis. So that's the big difference. And when we talk about inflation proofing, I think it's really important to recognize that because all the income flows into the earnings reserve account, none of the gain or income generated by the corpus gets reinvested into the corpus without that inflation proofing mechanism. So in other words, if we, for example, 10 years ago, we bought an office building, and the earnings reserve account buys a pro rata share of every investment that the fund holds. And if we assume for sake of math that it's a 4-to-1 ratio, that hotel was maybe that office building was $50 million, and we paid $40 million with the corpus and $10 million with the earnings reserve account. It's now 2017. We've held the hotel for 10 years. We decide it's time to sell it because it's time. The valuations demonstrate that it's time to sell. It's valued at $100 million now. It's doubled in value. That $50 million gain goes into the earnings reserve account. The $10 million that the earnings reserve account invested into that office building goes back into the earnings reserve account. And all the corpus gets is the original $40 million investment. Now, if you need that $60 million for other purposes, and it can't be reinvested for another 10 years into an office building or like-minded long-term investment, all we have to put back into real estate is that original $40 million. But now office buildings cost $100 million. So that's how we're losing the investment power, and why inflation proofing is so important, and why we have to distinguish between the earnings reserve account and what it can do versus the corpus and what it can do. They are two very different accounts. And as much as we would like to combine them and say it's all one, it's not, because you can't spend the corpus, but you can spend the earnings reserve account.
Thank you.
Okay, real good. Thank you. Next up, we've got Representative Wilson and then Pruitt and Guerra.
I'd also like to
recognize that we've been joined by Representative Thompson. Sorry. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. And this is not necessarily to get your opinion on any specific bill, but is there a mechanism that if a POMV at all, you know, is too high, that the corporation would be able to come back and alert the legislature that maybe we just had a lot of bad years, you know, but can a mechanism be put in place, or is there one to where in any of these plans we start doing it with no sunset, that you would know as a corporation that we might be getting in danger of making the corporation might be not be able to invest the way you do, or we're not actually protecting the permanent fund like we thought we were?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think it is definitely possible to put in those safeguards into any of the bills. I'm sorry, I think it's House Bill 61, the governor's bill by rules of the House, includes a provision that every 3 years there's a look back. I expect from my experience with this body that every year when we come back and talk about various reserve levels and where we are, you're going to be alerted well before that three-year mark, but it is nice to codify it in the bill itself to force a look back and a sort of check on whether or not things are working out the way you expected them to work out.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
A follow-up?
I just want to make sure I understand. And this bill currently doesn't have that provision in it.
It does not, through the chair, it does not to my recollection, no.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Riddell, for being here today. So I wanted to ask you just real briefly, one of the things that I haven't seen on any of the bills this year that we've talked in the past is giving you the tools to be able to manage what you have, whether it was the procurement changes, some of the other, now that we're, of course, putting more weight on you, do you still feel, as you did in the past, that some of those appropriate changes to give you the ability to hire and to manage the fund in the way that you see fit is still needed? And just for those that might not have been around, can you explain if you do feel that's still needed, you know, why you feel those were tools that were important for you to have?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, last year we asked for, and it was included in one of the versions, procurement language in particular, and that is an important tool. Right now, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation is not exempt from state procurement. Other agencies, such as Alaska Housing Finance Corporation or the Alaska Retirement Management Board, all have those exceptions to the procurement. What it means for us operationally is that unless you are an actual fiduciary to the fund, procurement of services, for example, say we wanted to hire an expert consultant for an idea that we were getting in private equity to validate the idea, say it was an engineering idea that had come about, we would have to go through the state's procurement process to hire that engineer, to hire an engineering consultant to view that idea. Oftentimes, investments don't have a 6 to 8 week lead time to allow for procurement and then get them up to speed, take a look at the investment, do the work, and then so we would be talking about potentially 12 weeks of delay, and so many times we would miss an opportunity if that was required. And so we have been simply seeking relief that our partners like the ARM board have on that front to give us the tools to manage more quickly and be more flexible and nimble in our response. None of the bills currently account for that, and we obviously would love to see it in one of these bills or in a standalone bill if that's a more appropriate venue on that front, because we would appreciate getting some relief from those types of rules. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And another question, actually, and kind of follow up with the discussion from Representative Guttenberg. I think it's really fascinating the kind of how you were highlighting that at this point in time, the earnings reserve itself has to be managed different than we've managed it in the past, is kind of what I think I was getting out of that. And I'm just trying to fully understand. I mean, obviously, if it's got to be liquid in a manner that we haven't needed it to be in the past, how does that impact the, I mean, we're looking at, you know, we're looking at a 4.75 in this particular bill. You know, the 6.95 is the goal that you had. Does your goal still remain if we start now needing to allow for that liquidity, meaning that not as risk adverse, will it still remain at that 6.95 for the fund overall, or does that change?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that's a challenging question for me to answer. And part of it is this tension of, we want you to do business as usual and continue to manage the fund the way you always have, and the target is the board target is actually 5% plus CPI. The 6.95% is a forecast base that Callan has generated for us based on our asset allocation, and it's the median forecast. So you have a 50% likelihood of achieving better and a 50% likelihood of achieving below that result. And why this is so challenging for me to answer is because now we're not leaving the earnings reserve account alone and just taking its statutory net income calculation and paying out dividends. Now we're using this for a budget stabilization fund. And my concern is that even though the percent of market value is sustainable, we have a fiduciary responsibility to be, you know, prudent and responsible. And I don't know, sitting here today, that if all we have left in the earnings reserve account after the budget's passed this year is $5 billion and the 4.75% draw or the 5.25% draw or the 6% draw that you ultimately decide on comes with an expectation that you're going to need $3 billion. I'm making up numbers now just for the record. $3 billion for fiscal year 18 or for fiscal year 19, and I'm saying 19 deliberately, that I'll want to invest that $5 billion the same way we would have sitting here today, knowing I've got to deliver. I can't lose hardly. I mean, we can't afford to lose. That it needs to stay there, that you need a minimum of $3 billion. And so that's why I get so challenged on answering these questions, because if we have a really bad down market, down 24%, like we did in 2008, and we had in excess of $2.5 billion of losses, what is the response if I come here in January of 2018 and tell you that we lost it all because the market is off? And that's what I get concerned about. Yeah. And that's what I'm trying to balance when I talk about these things, because I at least want recognition that if we're going to invest the way we always have, there needs to be a recognition that the earnings reserve account will lose some years, and what does that mean? And if you can't afford the loss, then maybe the solution is something different than what we're talking about, or it's a mitigation of what we're talking about. It's a recognition that it's not 6.95% on the earnings reserve account, or it's a recognition that there's other mechanisms that, you know, that we can we can talk about. But I just feel like while we're having this sort of back and forth discussion, I put those concerns, because I recognize the challenge that we're facing in this state, and the need for using the fund. So I don't want you to in any way take my comments as don't touch leave us alone. That's not what I'm saying at all.
Yeah, thank you. I may have more, but thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Okay, next up we've got Representative Guerra, then Thompson and Ortiz.
Thank you. Director O'Dell, appreciate it. Appreciate all your work. Fair to say, no matter, and I ask this of Mr. Teal too, fair to say that whether we pick 4%, 5.25%, 4.5%, if we have a bunch of bad stock market years, and we do a statutory POMV, we're probably in trouble, and we're going to have to deal with it at that point. Correct? Is that fair to say?
Through the chair, yes, I think that's fair to say.
And so, obviously, nobody thinks that there's that a constitutional amendment is really likely. So, so if you have majority support to do something with the earnings reserve, it's going to be statutory. Just leaving, assuming that the legislature will react appropriately if we have a bunch of terrible stock market years, you know, and none of those PMV formulas ended up working because basically you have no earnings left. Mm-hmm. Assuming the legislature recognized that reality and they'd have to deal with that if that happened. That aside, David Thiel's testimony was, in general, and I know you have your concerns about inflation proofing, which I want to address next. But in general, he said, "Look, you can do a 4.25% PMV. You could do a 5.25% PMV of five of the last 6 years. Those, in his view, all seemed reasonable. You know, provided that you recognize if you have a bunch of terrible stock market years, you're gonna have to do something different." Are you able to say, is that something you can agree with?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think all of the numbers being talked about today are in the realm of reasonableness, yes.
And through the chair.
Follow.
To be fair to you, I mean, you've been very clear that, you know, as much as we have a budget crisis, you've been clear that at some point you'd like to see inflation-proofing return. The last 2 years, there wasn't any. We're still strapped, but at some point it'll make you feel more comfortable if there was some sort of inflation-proofing mechanism. It's fair to say?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's absolutely correct, and it goes back to my point about protecting the fund for all generations of Alaskans. And this primarily goes to the investment power for future generations, because if we want future generations of Alaskans to get the same type of benefits that we're receiving off the fund, the only way for them to get that is for the corpus to retain its investment power that it has today. And it would be diminished without investment, without inflation proofing.
Thank you. Through the chair.
Hello.
Let me ask you this. I mean, I know for you the most comfortable part of inflation proofing would be if somebody sucked a bunch of money into the principal, right? That's the most comfortable thing, I think, for the permanent fund.
I think the most comfortable place for us to be is to recognize it somewhere in the waterfall, preferably at the top, before it gets, you know, so take a little bit each year. If you did a large sum, is the question that we're going to keep track of what inflation proofing would have been in 16, 17, and all the years we're taking a moratorium, and then we calculate what the future value of that, so it's that amount plus. So we're kind of talking, you know, and then you put that amount in. You know, that's definitely a possibility without knowing what inflation in those future years is going to be. But arguably what you know, to me, the most comfortable place to be is just to include it in the waterfall somewhere.
Through the chair.
Follow up?
And what if we had a formula so you knew, I mean, the formula is like you've seen in all the bills, where somebody says, look, we're not taking more than a certain amount out of earnings, and the earnings reserve were to grow, earnings reserve is part of the permanent fund, right? If you saw the earnings reserve growing and the legislature sticking by its formula, even if you didn't do annual inflation proofing, would that cause you some comfort that the legislature let that grow and stuck to its formula?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I guess the honest answer is no, because the earnings reserve account can be spent for any purpose at any time. And so let's assume in your example that the earnings reserve account, I mean, you're sticking to the formula and the earnings reserve account is growing, but then something catastrophic happens and you have a really bad budget gap year where the draw can't be stuck to, that you need to draw something bigger than what the 4.5, 5.25% draws would generate. And the fact that there's always the flexibility given on the earnings reserve account, part of the nice thing about the inflation proofing is it goes back into the corpus and it keeps that corpus value growing so that you're not caught in the debate about what the earnings reserve account, the debate we're having today about what the earnings reserve account should be spent for.
And then finally, through the chair. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you probably gave the answer, but let's say you just had a hard cap on what could be spent out of the earnings reserve. That still wouldn't cause you some comfort?
No.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, next up we've got Representative Thompson and then Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Ms. Rodell, from what I'm hearing, and maybe you can clarify it for me a little bit, it seems like that this bill doesn't have anything in it to address volatility of revenue. Yet it looks to me like maybe the governor's fiscal plan does have some items in it that does address volatility of revenue. Am I reading that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, I think comparing these two bills is a little bit challenging because this one includes the income tax provisions, so there's a different revenue outcome than the governor's bill has in terms of volatility. So if I speak to it globally, I think probably the way to take my caution more than volatility is just a recognition of the fact that we need to not be the only answer in some cases, and that's because we will have volatility in outcome. And so how much of that you're willing to take, I don't know.
Thank you.
I'm sure I didn't answer your question, Mr.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rodell, the very first question that you had, you responded and you said that for good reason you weren't comfortable in giving some sort of nod towards one type of plan over another type of plan. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, we're going to have to make a decision of one type of plan over another type of plan or no plan at all. Mm-hmm. And so the question, I guess, is it safe to assume that the number one potential impact on any plan that we have, potential negative impact, is without a doubt stock market or investment return fluctuation? That's the biggest. That's the biggest threat in terms of the success of any plan. Is it safe to say that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it is safe to say that. And I think I want to also clarify for you, we don't necessarily need to be talking about a down market where we're down 20%, you know, sort of these 1 in 20 year events. We're talking about what if we're returning 1% a year for a variety of reasons. So the stock market is really like it was in 15, where it's really volatile throughout the year. So you're up, you're way down, you're way up, so that at the end you returned 1% and you have fixed income rates staying low and things like that. So it's not even concern about multiple years of losses. It's of really low returns where you're not able to generate significant amounts of income. So just recognizing that that might happen and what the potential impact is on a plan, and creating that volatility in, and the idea that, you know, we've faced a lot of volatility in revenue sources through oil commodity prices, and we're still going to have potentially volatility in revenue, although it probably would be smoother than it's been in the past because of the five-year average and some of the things that are being done.
Okay. If I can follow up?
Follow up.
So then, setting aside the volatility of returns, for me as an individual legislator, is it as simple as looking at the different plans and the difference in those plans as to the percent of the POMV draw, and then weighing that off as a trade-off in the lower the POMV draw, the less potential revenue there is for GF. Is that really what it's about? Is that simple?
Through the chair, I believe, yes, it is that simple. Not so simple, but yes, yeah. That simple.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Back on the inflation discussion, you had said something that I wanted to make sure I understood. So from your perspective in terms of, you know, inflation, we haven't done it over the last couple of years, and the way that this current bill, though, or I think not just this bill, but I think several of the bills have put out there a way to deal with that was the four times amount, and then it spills over at that point in time. But it sounds like that could create a situation where we're not allowing the corpus to maintain at the level that we need it to going forward. If I understood what you said, you feel that in the discussion, and maybe in particular with like this bill, for example, where two-thirds of it goes towards government and a third of it goes towards the dividend, in that calculation, should we include some form of inflation in so that it's kind of a standard, this is what we're going to do? And then secondarily, how would we design something? How would we design that? Would it just be follow CPI? I mean, how do we balance that?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I think what's helpful about this bill and HB 61 is that they do provide at least a mechanism of inflation proofing as opposed to eliminating the concept altogether. The calculation of four times, though, has no relationship to inflation or what would have been deposited had the traditional the current existing statutory language stayed in place. And so, but it does create a recognition that some money should flow back into the corpus. I think the way, and you know, we can do this offline and meet too, but I think some of the ways that you can think about it is the definition of statutory net income, or I know this bill eliminated available for distribution, I believe, and changed it to market value. But so depending on how you wanted to do it, if you wanted to, like I said, put it in a waterfall, or if you, in the definition of statutory net income, subtract an amount out, and then statutory net income by definition then is the amount available for distribution that or that's deposited into the earnings reserve account. There's probably a couple of formats. But obviously, like I said, it's important that the bills at least contemplate inflation proofing and not do away with it altogether, because I think it's very hard when when language is repealed to then come back and go, well, this is really important and try to get it back. So I just want to recognize that it does have a mechanism, even though it's not perfect, and what would be perfect is something higher up where it was more automatic each year rather than if we happen to hit an earnings target.
And follow up. What if part of it was just, of course, changing definitions? And so, for example, maybe the definition of income is changed. That deals with the fact that, and back to your building example, that $40 million that you would place, well, now it's 10 years later, that $40 million with inflation, it should be valued at X. And so that the income that remains within the principal is now whatever would have been adjusted. Is it definition mechanisms that we could use, or does it need to stick to?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I'm going to defer now because now we're getting into sort of constitutional law interpretations and the definition of income and how much you can define income in statute, what was included as a word. And there's been 35 years, obviously, the permanent fund's in place 40 years, and there's been a series of attorney general interpretations as time has gone on, and we've added different kinds of investments to the fund. So I would hesitate to respond fully to that, but I think we can probably follow up with your office on what might options be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We've got two questions, one from Representative Seaton, and then right here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The four times the draw remaining and the waterfall, so anything above that would be designated for inflation proofing. You know, in the modeling, it does take effect, but not every year. Trying to balance the draw and inflation proofing, I was just trying to look and if a quarter of a percent, in other words, the draw was increased to 5.25% was then dedicated to inflation proofing, is that the kind of waterfall mechanism that you're looking at as far as a percentage of the draw going into inflation proofing the principal?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it is the kind of mechanism. Yes.
Okay, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director O'Dell, having the current statute saying inflation proofing is nice is just the legislature doesn't follow it anymore, or hasn't the last 2 years. So, a statement and a question. It seems to me one of the bigger threats to inflation proofing is the failure for the state to have a way out of this fiscal crisis, because the last 2 years has caused the legislature from putting a penny into inflation proofing, even though there's a statute. So do you have any opinion whether if we continue to allow this fiscal crisis to go unabated, that's a threat to inflation proofing too?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, my job is to protect the corpus of the fund.
Fair enough. I probably shouldn't have drawn you over there. I'll just say it's clear to me. and it's been 2 years that the fund has not been inflation proofed. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Okay. Definitely don't. You know, I know the fund can't get involved in politics. You, in response to Representative Thompson's question, you said something interesting to me, and I don't know if you can elaborate on it. He asked you about the various bills, and you said something to the effect that maybe I misinterpreted, that since this bill was not just relying on permanent fund revenue to run public services, but also had another element that produced revenue that gave you a little bit more comfort. Maybe I misstated that. Can you just state your views on that and what you meant?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Garrett, what I was trying to point out was that the bills they're not apples and oranges comparison, because there's other income and that I haven't seen models on it, have dampening effects that other bills don't have because of the combination nature of looking at it in its entirety as a bill, as opposed to pulling two bills together and making that a plan. Does that?
Through the chair.
Hold on.
When you say dampening effects, do you mean less pressure on the permanent fund if there is extra revenue coming in besides revenue from the permanent fund?
Through the chair, correct.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing no further questions, thank you, Ms. Riddell. We've got two more people available for questions. The first is Carl Davis, and the next one would be Ken Opper. So I'd like to open up questions to Carl Davis if he's, I believe, online, or is he available here? He's the research director from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. And are you with us, Carl?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, if you could just put your name and affiliation on the record, and we'll open it up for questions.
Sure. I'm Carl Davis, the research director at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. We're a nonprofit and nonpartisan research shop based in Washington, D.C.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Davis. Are there any questions of Mr. Davis? We've got a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Just wanted to go over, we have a paper in our binder here, but have you got experience with Alaska's tax system and fiscal situation?
Yes, we authored two reports on Alaska's fiscal situation last year. The first looked at a variety of different packages for raising revenue in order to help close the budget gap. The way we do these analyses is we maintain what's called a micro-simulation tax model. This is similar to what the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Committee on Taxation maintain at the federal level. A number of states maintain these models as well. Basically, it contains a wealth of information on taxpayers' incomes, their consumption habits, what sorts of properties they own, how much gasoline they buy. And when a proposal to change state tax law is floated, we can run that proposal through the model and see how it would impact a state's population. So we have this model for Alaska, for the other 49 states, and for the nation as a whole. So we can analyze changes in the dividend, the permanent fund dividend, the creation of an income tax, the creation of a sales tax, gasoline tax changes, and these sorts of things, and show we can produce a revenue figure similar to what you already have in the fiscal note that the Department of Revenue put together for the amount of revenue that the tax would raise, and we can also break down that amount of revenue by income level, so to show whether a tax would fall primarily on middle-income families or on high-income earners, or will it tend to fall most heavily on low-income families. We can answer those sorts of questions on a state-by-state basis with our model. And the focus of our report so far have been largely on changes in the dividend and the potential of enacting an income tax and how those two might balance alongside each other, because we recognize that Alaska is facing a fiscal challenge that there is no one solution that you can just enact one policy change and close the entire gap. It's likely going to have to be a package of changes. And so how that package is comprised ends up having very different impacts in terms of the distribution. And so if it's a package that tends to rely more heavily on scaling back the dividend, that might be a change that will tend to hit lower income families more. If it relies more on a progressive income tax, that could hit higher income families more. If you have a mix of the two, you may end up with a result that's closer to what we call proportional overall. You end up with similar shares of income being paid by folks at different income levels.
Follow up.
And just wondering what kind of workload and how what timing is on a work product, looking at the provisions we have in House Bill 115 and how that would look as distributionally across the state in your model. Is that something that can be done in some reasonable time frame?
Yeah. Yes, we're intending to look at this within the next few weeks. I'm hesitant to give an exact time frame because sometimes I'll make a promise on when we can get analysis done, and it ends up being a lot more complicated than we realize. We like to take our time with these and make sure we're capturing all the nuances correctly. I have taken a preliminary look at the income tax in this bill, and I can comment on where it stacks up nationally, if that would be helpful.
Sure, that Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely, Mr. Davis. Go ahead.
So it's tricky comparing income taxes across states because every state has, you know, different exemptions, different deductions, different rates, and that sort of thing. But the simplest way to do this kind of comparison is just to measure, well, how large is the tax overall relative to a state's economy. And what we found is relative to Alaskans' personal income, this tax would collect about 1.5% of the state's personal income. Now, that rate's going to vary by income level. If you're very low income and you're only paying the $25 minimum tax, it could be a rate significantly below 1.5%. whereas if you're higher income, it could be a rate above 1.5. But on average, this is a tax equal to about 1.5% of Alaska personal income. And relative to what we see in other states, this would be the fourth lowest broad-based personal income tax in the nation. So right now, the lowest personal income tax in the nation is in North Dakota. You may be aware it's the second most energy dependent state in the country in terms of where its public revenues come from. That's not an accident. This obviously, if you have significant energy revenues, you can raise revenues in non-traditional ways. So North Dakota also has a 5% sales tax, though, so that also helps explain why they have such a low income tax. And the other two states are Arizona and Louisiana. They would have smaller income taxes than what's proposed in this bill. But in Arizona, they get by levying the 11th highest sales tax rates in the country. And Louisiana actually recently took the top spot on the sales tax. They have an average sales tax rate approaching 10% when state and local sales taxes are combined. So these other states that have income taxes smaller than what's proposed here, it's generally because they also have either significant energy revenues in North Dakota's case or more often very significant sales tax revenues as well.
Well, good. Any follow-up, Representative Seaton?
No. I guess I'd just like if he could send that information to us, email or whatever, so we can get it in writing. I'm trying to write things down, but it's harder. But it'd be great to have that comparison of where we fall with other states.
Sure, and we'll make sure that my staff follows up on that. Representative Guerra?
Thanks, Mr. Davis. That's useful information. I don't know if you're able to answer a related question, which is, assuming states did what they don't do, which is tax at a percentage of the federal income tax rate, is there any way you could measure this bill and figure out where it ranks with other states that have an income tax in terms of what percentage of the federal tax rate states are charging?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just my back of the envelope math is that this bill tops out slightly below 6% on ordinary income, and that's simply taking the top federal tax rate of 39.6% and taking 15% of that. And that is below the national average, or at least the national median, in terms of and the national average as well, in terms of a top income tax rate of 6.4% is the median rate. So it is the sort of thing we can... we can take a look by income level and see how it stacks up for on a more fine grained level, as opposed to this very broad, 1.5% of total Alaska income. We can see how it stacks up by income level. I'm sorry, does that answer your question?
I guess it would be useful to know. Just in terms of, like, if we're looking at what percentage of the federal tax rate we're charging, how that stacks up to what percentage of the federal tax rate other states charge, even though they tax differently. Like, I know they have individual percentages as opposed to taxing a percentage of federal taxes, but what I'd like to know, I guess, is maybe what the average percentage of federal taxes other states charge is, and that would help us.
I can definitely do that. I understand now. I can put those together and send that along with the other numbers I mentioned.
Thanks. And just one other question, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thanks. Just because I only look at my own taxes when I file my federal income tax rate taxes. How many tax brackets are there in the federal tax code?
I don't know that off the top of my head, and I don't believe I'm probably not the only person that doesn't, because most people you calculate your you reach your, you find your tax in the tax table at the end that doesn't even show you the number of brackets. But the advantage of doing this over the phone is I can actually look up the answer for you. So there are seven federal brackets. But, you know, at the, in terms of, sometimes this is mentioned, this is brought up in the context of simplicity and whether having more brackets is more complicated or less complicated. And the fact of the matter is that for most taxpayers, they don't even notice how many brackets there are because they have a table at the end of the tax booklet that reports a tax amount based on their taxable income. It's the number of brackets is something that it needs to be thought through carefully, but for the average taxpayer, it's not something they even generally notice.
The chair.
Hello.
Yeah, Mr. Davis, so what I'm getting at is it might be that there's a proposal to say let's tax a certain percentage of the federal tax, but we do that by, let's say we pick 15% of the federal tax. We just go into each of those tax brackets and tax 15% of that tax bracket per bracket so that way we have, and so if 15%, if one of the tax brackets is, let's say, 5%, or let's say if one of the tax brackets is like 20% and we were to tax 15% of that for that bracket, I guess that would be 3%. And that way, if federal taxes went up and down, at least we would have a set number in statute. That's why I was asking. Would you be able to provide us those seven tax brackets?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable approach in terms of lessening the vulnerability of the tax to whatever changes might be passed by Congress. There, you'd have to think through how federal tax credits come into play. It seems feasible to me. Another approach, if you're interested in limiting in keeping a linkage to federal tax liability, but limiting the extent to which it will swing with whatever changes happen to be enacted at the federal level, what some states do is use what's called fixed date conformity, where they don't just automatically couple to whatever the internal revenue code happens to be at that moment. They couple to a version of federal law. So you could say Alaska's income tax is based on federal law as of January 1st, 2017. And then that date can be updated from time to time if the federal government enacts tax changes. But when you're debating whether to update that date, you'll have information at your disposal to say, okay, well, what changes has Congress enacted and what does this mean if we update the date from January 1, 2017 to January 1, 2018 when federal taxes might be significantly lower. So that's worth being aware of.
Thanks.
Okay, next up we've got Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in, so thank you for being online. Let's see, it's late, if you're on D.C., it's late over there or it's into the evening. What I'm interested in is your perspective on comparing apples to apples. Sometimes it's very hard to analyze things when they're so different from Alaska to other states. You know, if you're looking at a tax liability in the state, comparing Alaska to any place else, you know, you start off with a permanent fund on that calculation. Some people do, some people don't. But in other places, you have sales tax where sometimes there's caps on the maximum. So if you buy a new car and you buy a slightly older car, the maximum would tax would be the same. In income tax, there are deductions and other calculations. So kind of the ballpark question is, how accurate or how close an assessment can you get comparing one state to the next with such different structures and deductions? And, you know, in Alaska we have, things that are unique to Alaska and not common in other places. So how close can you get to that where you can tell us what actually it is an accurate comparison?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is complicated because every taxpayer's financial situation is so different. So if you happen to be, you have two folks with identical incomes, but if one happens to own a much larger home than the other, or a home in a more expensive area, they'll pay significantly more property tax, or if their buying habits are different, they'll pay significantly more sales tax, or even where their sources of income come from, because under the federal income tax and most state income taxes, Social Security income enjoys a partial or even a full exemption. So you can construct hypothetical examples to illustrate how folks are affected at different levels. On the topic of trying to work through how specific folks are impacted by these different mix of policy options, I think one interesting thing to note is that if you were just to, say, take a $500 million revenue package, and if you were to do it as a sales tax or as an income tax, for example, the folks at the University of Alaska actually did a study on this and found that most Alaska residents would end up paying significantly less under the income tax option than under the sales tax option. And this is because an income tax is able to raise more revenue from folks with very large incomes, and it means that having the revenues that you'd be collecting from low-income taxpayers or middle-income taxpayers or frankly even upper-middle-income taxpayers are significantly lower under the income tax. So the mix, or something like the permanent fund dividend, with it being unique to Alaska as well, it does complicate comparisons across states. It's something we try to be mindful about, but it is hard to generalize too much because it depends so much on each taxpayer's specific financial situation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we've got Representative Pruitt and then Gren.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for calling in today and spending some time with us. I just want to ask a few questions. I just want to understand exactly who we're talking to tell you the truth, and why you're the one we're talking to. There's a ton of people that have thoughts on income. So I just really questions to help me understand kind of where you guys come from. Have you worked on tax policy, specifically income sales, whatever tax policy for the Alaska legislature before?
We do research in 50 states, and we're a small organization, so sometimes we can be spread a little bit thin. Last year, we did a report supported by the Rasmussen Foundation, it was not work with the legislature. This is just a report that we published online and made available to the public and the press and legislators and anyone else that cared to read it. We're funded by foundations. You can find a list of our funders on our website, folks like the Annie Casey Foundation and the Ford Foundation, and we do largely pro bono work using our tax model to help fill informational voids at the state level. So at the federal level, there are already a lot of folks doing distributional analyses and revenue analyses of tax policy changes. At the state level, it varies significantly from state to state, the capacity within government to do those sorts of analyses. And so we'll find ourselves filling gaps sometimes when there's a bill that's being considered that hasn't been fully analyzed yet. We can use our model to help shed some light on what that bill means to taxpayers at different income levels.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So in reading the one sheet that we have on you, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, just want to read something that's on it. But your mission states that
I don't know if you just shorten it as ITAP or how you guys do that. ITAP is committed to fair and sustainable tax laws that protect lower-income Americans from aggressive policies while generating revenues adequate to serve the public interest. ITAP's timely, accessible, and accurate analysis support advocacy groups and public servants who share that commitment. What I don't see in the mission statement is a conversation related to the impact on the private sector, the impact on the economy as a whole. What role do you take in terms of the private sector, the impact of tax policy on the private sector, impacts of the tax policy on the economy as a whole? What role does that play in the models that you guys have?
Yeah, so this is a debate that's happening. There's a discussion of dynamic scoring and whether tax policy changes should be analyzed in the light of what broader ripple impacts will they have on the economy. I mean, it's more straightforward matter to say, under the current economy, how would this tax proposal or that tax proposal, what would the revenues be, what would the distributional impact be? When you start to try to determine what the impact on the broader economy is going to be, the question becomes immensely more complicated, particularly at the state level, because at the state level, states are generally not able to run a deficit for a sustained amount of time, and so any change in tax policy is generally going to lead to a change in spending policy as well. And so there are states that if you were to change, if you change tax policy, there are analysts that will attempt to analyze, well, what is the economic impact of that change in tax policy? Well, that's, you can't answer that question unless you realize, or unless you also analyze exactly what that tax policy change would fund. And so if it's money that would have been spent on infrastructure, there are measurable impacts of infrastructure spending as well, and there are longer-term, less measurable impacts of education spending. So the economic analysis of tax policy, it frankly becomes much more speculative. And what we tend to find at the state level is that it's not an there are limited things that states can do in terms of their tax policy in order to impact their economies. We've seen recently from evidence from states that have changed their personal income tax rates. If you look at the states that have changed their income taxes recently, about half of them do better after they made that change, about half of them do worse. It's hard to tease out the effect of the tax policy change in particular because there are so many other things happening. Manufacturing happens to be declining at the time, or if your state is enjoying an influx of residents moving there for the nice weather, or whatever other thing might be happening, it's very difficult to tease out the economic impacts. And so we that's a component that's not as easily measurable and analyzable as the distributional impacts.
So Mr. Chair, just kind of try to. So if I understand correctly, you focus on what it takes to fill the gap and the levers that we could move to limit the impact on certain populations. That's solely what you focus on. The economic analysis is really for us to determine separately. Am I speaking out of turn with that, or is that appropriate?
Yeah, I think that's appropriate. I'll add that we also do not measure or make statements or judgments as to the appropriate level of taxes. That's completely outside of our purview. Once it's decided that a certain amount of revenue needs to be raised, we can help fill in gaps about, well, what does it mean to raise it this way or that way. In terms of the economic impact, it's frankly just much more speculative, and it's not something that can usefully be modeled with economic models at the state level, in my opinion.
Okay, thank you. Next up, we've got a question from Representative Gren.
Mr. Davis, thanks for calling in. I appreciate the time. This kind of speaks to your your previous answers, actually. I was wondering, since you are probably in front of a computer, like you said, I'm trying to think of the most recent state that implemented an income tax. I know that Michigan did several years ago or a few years ago, but if there was a state since Michigan that has implemented a state income tax, perhaps describe the environment that that income tax was implemented, and if your institute did any briefs or reports with that state that we could have access to. Thanks.
Yes. So the last two states to enact income taxes, Connecticut in 1991, I believe it was, expanded what was a tax just on investment income and made it a much more of a true income tax on wages and any other sorts of income that a taxpayer might earn. And then New Jersey in the 1970s. What we generally find is that the states that enacted income taxes, they were facing situations that, at least in their broad strokes, are not so different from what Alaska is facing. That is, they're facing a budget gap. So that's, you know, these tend to come during, you know, tougher times. And I've seen recently an analysis making the rounds about the 11 states that most recently enacted income taxes. As far as I know, the source of this, and I first encountered this talking point a few years ago, and the source of this, I believe, is Arthur Laffer, who you might be familiar with from the famous Laffer curve, the idea that certain types of tax cuts can produce just such explosive economic growth that they ultimately pay for themselves. To be honest with you, this look at these 11 states, I think it could have been useful if this were a randomized experiment and we were looking at 11 states spread out across the country in demographically or economically diverse areas. In truth, all of these 11 states were concentrated in the Midwest and Appalachia and the Northeast, many states that you might characterize as the Rust Belt, Michigan, West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Indiana. So there is this history of states that have recently enacted income taxes. It's hard to, again, as I was just speaking to, it's hard to tease out the effects of tax policy changes on their economy versus other bigger picture things that were already going on with manufacturing or westward migration.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Are you familiar with any other states that have a minimum tax like we have in House Bill 115? We have a $25 minimum tax for any filer. Has that been something that other states have used?
We see this under corporate income taxes more commonly. Minimum tax is $100 or $250 or $500. Under the personal income tax, I don't believe any state has one of these right now, and in fact, a lot of states will allow their income taxes to go negative with through refundable credits, things like the Earned Income Tax Credit, which I believe is offered in 26 states now, although not all those are refundable. Most of them are, though. So the minimum tax, but, you know, Alaska, again, is such a unique state with the permanent fund dividend. It may be, I understand that it may take some of the interest in refundable tax credits off the table that we see in other states, states like Oklahoma that offer, they don't have a minimum tax, and they offer refundable credits to offset things like their sales tax on groceries. Hawaii is like this as well. So, you know, the minimum tax is mainly at the state level, mainly confined to the corporate income tax.
Follow up?
A different question.
Mm-hmm. Another question?
I guess I'm curious, you know, we've got what we think, or I think, is a pretty simple tax here, 15% of line 56 plus 10% of line 13 being the tax. And we're trying to figure out whether if we didn't do that and we went to generating each of the exemptions and each of the deductions and the different tax brackets and what those percentages would be for those tax brackets. Have you followed debates on income taxes in other states, and were the generation of those exemption and deduction and percent for tax brackets long and complicated compared to something that's as simple as 15% of line 56 and 10% of line 13?
Yeah, in setting the, I haven't followed because it's been so long since a state has enacted an income tax, but there are states that have changed their brackets recently, and a lot of that negotiation tends to happen behind closed doors, and there are so many trade-offs involved. If we change this bracket by this amount, but also change this exemption by this amount, and perhaps change the sales tax base in this way. So it's true there are a lot of moving pieces. I think we see that, I mean, at the same time, there are other states, though, like Alabama or Virginia or West Virginia, that enacted brackets and exemptions, personal exemptions, decades ago, and don't seem to have revisited them at all in the years since. And in some cases, that's a problem because they wrote their bracket and exemption amounts in flat dollar terms. And what ends up happening over time is what's known as bracket creep, whereas if you've written all these flat dollar amounts into the law that are never updated for inflation, eventually everybody, the personal exemption is so small in real dollars as to become meaningless, and everybody's subject to the top income tax rate, whereas the state, you know, if you sent a $5,000 exemption back decades ago, maybe that was a significant bracket, whereas today it's almost just a token bracket where most people would fall in that top income tax bracket. So, you know, this is a fact, though, under any sort of tax. Honestly, you might even see it more under the sales tax in terms of negotiating over exemptions. You see state sales tax bases tend to be incredibly narrow, not just carve-outs for things like groceries or prescription drugs that are meant to blunt the regressivity, but there are exemptions for broad types of services, whether personal services like haircuts and massages, or whether they're business services like accounting or legal fees, or industry-specific exemptions in some cases. So under any kind of broad-based tax, there's always going to be a lot of wrangling over which exemptions should be created or which exemptions should be closed.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Are there any other questions? Representative Guerra has a question.
Thank you. I guess it doesn't matter terribly, but are there any states that just take the federal taxable income line and then come up with their own tax rate within each bracket so that you don't fight over exemptions and deductions and just accept the federal ones?
Yes, there are, and I actually looked this up just prior to the hearing. The states that start with taxable income are Colorado, Minnesota, North Dakota, South Carolina, and Vermont, and then they apply their own brackets and usually offer their own tax credits as well. But they start with federal taxable income, which makes their forms significantly shorter and simpler. So there are all sorts of, if you want to couple to federal rules in order to simplify things, states will often couple to federal adjusted gross income, but you're right that coupling to federal taxable income would simplify things in terms of it comes prepackaged with a personal exemption, a standard deduction, and a set of itemized deductions.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, through the chair. And I guess I've been meaning to ask this question because I don't know the answer. There's a taxable income line and there's an adjustable gross income line. I know there are a few different lines of your income on your income tax form. I can't remember what they are. And what are the differences between, is it taxable income and adjustable gross income, or aren't there two different lines of what your income is under the federal tax form?
Yes, at least two. There's gross, yes, the two lines that you'll see are adjusted gross income, which is a fairly comprehensive measure of income, although it does include certain adjustments for things like self-employment taxes you might have paid, or moving expenses, I believe. There's a handful of adjustments. I think it's Schedule 1, I can't remember. But yes, adjusted gross income is a fairly broad measure of income. And then what's applied after that is you can subtract out a personal exemption of roughly $4,000 for each person in your household, and then you can subtract either your standard deduction, or if you happen to be a homeowner, in most cases, what you'll subtract instead is what you paid in property taxes, in mortgage interest, and then you can also subtract things like your charitable donations, your state income tax payment, for if you live in a state that has an income tax, or if you live in a state that does not have an income tax, now you can deduct your sales taxes. So the taxable income definition is lower down the form, and by the time you get to that point, you've already subtracted out more exemptions and deductions, so it tends to be a smaller amount for most people.
Thanks.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. By any chance, do you know what the minimum amount it is that you can earn? I know children sometimes, the parents have to file on their behalf. How much income does one have to have before they have to file?
In 2016, for a single taxpayer, they would have to earn just over $10,000, $10,350. And for a married couple, it's double that. They have to earn $20,700. And there's also the head of household filing status. So if you're single but you you take care of children, then you don't have to file unless you earn over $13,350 per year. But for all of those taxpayers, well, not for all of them, but for many of those taxpayers, they might choose to file anyway in order to claim certain tax credits, like the child tax credit or the earned income tax credit. So just because you don't have to file, it doesn't mean that you won't file a federal return.
So follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, President Wilson.
I thought it was much lower. I thought it was like $400 or $500 of interest or income that somebody had to file. They still got it all back. So you're telling me that unless someone has at least $13,000, a single person has at least $13,000 worth of income, they don't have to file?
Yes, and this is because I believe that number is built from taking the personal exemption, so nobody is taxed on their first $4,000 of income because they have the personal exemption. And then the standard deduction, nobody's taxed on that next $6,000 or so, I believe, of income because they can also claim a standard deduction. So when those two things are combined, it creates this what's sometimes called a filing threshold below which you don't owe tax and don't need to file.
And Representative Wilson, I think that there's also, I mean, he's talking about earned income, but right. There's also a $1,050 threshold, I believe, for unearned income. So if you get more than $1,050 from unearned income, then you qualify to file as well.
So if I understand that correctly, Mr. Chairman, so if our dividend's $1,100, everybody in the state would be required to file.
Either that or children receiving that can be filed on their parents' form. But other than those that are filed as dependent children on their parents' form would have to. But we'll get Mr. Alper up here. He's the next one up, and we'll ask.
Okay,
he's
thank
the tax
you.
Division. We'll ask him.
When do the children have to file? They gotta file.
Are there any other? Seeing no other questions, thank you very much, Mr. Davis. Really appreciate your testimony, and we'll look forward to your email on those answers. And let's have Ken Alper come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the director of the Tax Division for the Department of Revenue. Could I just ask you a question to start? When are you intending to finish the meeting? I thought for some reason you were expecting to adjourn at 3 o'clock. I'm here at your service as long as you stay, but I just noticed the time.
We're 3:30.
Excellent. Thank you. So, Mr. Chairman.
Before you start into the fiscal notes, there have been a couple of questions on the table. If you could kind of elucidate those for us.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, you might want to have someone restate the question. There's a lot of things floating around. I can't speak authoritatively about the federal tax code, obviously. I'm primarily responsible for administering Alaska's taxes, but I might be able to provide a little bit of insight. What question should we go to first?
I think the last one that Representative Wilson was asking on what it takes to be required to file a federal tax form.
Yeah. Through the chair to Representative Wilson's question, I don't know with any certainty. I do know that my personal taxes, my family's are prepared by an accountant, so I'm assuming he follows all the rules, and I have three children, and even when the dividend was over $2,000 a couple of years ago, they were able to file as part of my family return.
Representative Wilson, did you want to follow up on that at all?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, because what we just heard right now is that you're not required to file if you, you know, get certain things back or over $13,000 or whatever it was. And so if the $13,000 is correct, then really the $25 minimum that we're talking about would never, the only people would be catching would people who got earned income back, some of your lowest income people, and then we'd be taking money from that. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the way I understand the $25 minimum tax is it would be per the filer, and anyone who is required to file the tax return, which is pretty much anyone earning any sort of income in the state, would be filing the return and would pay, if the formula otherwise sent them to zero, $25. But for children or for minors, people who don't have any wage income, if they're part of a household and they're dependent on someone else's return, I think they'd be part of that person's tax calculation.
Mm. And Representative Wilson, if you look at the tax tables that are provided in your packet, just for instance, on about the third page, there's married couple with four children, and you'll see at 20 and 40 and all the way up to 70,000, there is a $25 minimum tax. Other people, single with no children, you see they never reach that $25 minimum. They're paying at $20,000. If you go up further, you'll see that there's whole differences. A single person with two children would pay the minimum through $40,000. That's the second to the last, third to the last page. And then they would be paying at $50,000, they would be paying $243 for the Alaska income tax. So I think that you can look across that line and you can see that it's highly dependent upon the structure of how you're filing, whether you're married or whether you're single, whether you have one, two, four children.
But Mr. Chairman, I guess what I'm trying to figure out, so if I make $19,999, I wouldn't pay anything because that's why we're starting at $20,000. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, what, because it starts at $20,000. I'm just trying to figure out, because we've made it sound like everybody pretty much had to give the $25 if they, you know, weren't at whatever level it takes to start, I guess, $30,000 if you're married with no children. But what I just heard from the gentleman we just had online was that until you got to $13,000, he was using for single. Married was, I think, close to the $20,000 that they could choose to file because they might be low enough to get earned income, you know, back. But if you didn't, but if you're not eligible because you might be a little bit over that, then you're not going to file and you won't have to give anything. So I could have two people making the same kind of income. One gets earned income because maybe there's two of them versus one, and one's just not going to file and pay nothing. The other one's only filing so they can get some income back in their household, and then we're going to get them out of $25 as well.
And Representative Wilson, this tax table is not the complete tax table, so if you want to see the, you know, from the lowest, I mean, this was made so that it was within the relevant relevant taxable incomes, and you can see on the first page where it would start and below that. But if someone filed and there are 13, you can see that the federal tax as a percent of gross income is 0.00. So if you make $20,000 and you're married with no children filing jointly, then you're not going to pay any federal tax, and so you are going to pay a $25 minimum tax to the state. But you're not going to have to, you haven't reached enough income to pay more than the 25. As soon as you go to $30,000, you've reached to where you're actually paying $140.
And Mr. Chairman, and if I understand correctly, that there could be a situation, too, where a child would have to, depending upon how much their interest or other income that they may receive, maybe from some, a fund that was left from their grandparents or whatever, and they get, interest. So there could be, I think most of this we're looking at as adults, but there is also situations where children may end up paying the $25 or more as well. So this is not just for adults. Sure. Just wanted to make sure I was understanding it.
Yep.
Thank you.
Are there, Representative Guerra?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'll ask you, I just want to make sure I understood, the $25 minimum tax that applies to every adult who doesn't have a federal tax liability, is that correct?
No, it's to any filer, anybody that's required to file would pay the minimum $25, or as you can see from the first page, they're married with no children. At $30,000, they're paying a $140 tax, so they're not paying $25 in addition. It's either $25 is the minimum tax that those people are contributing.
Thank you. Through the chair.
Yes.
Mr. Alper, or whoever wants to answer. So that's the part I have some confusion on, who the $25 minimum tax applies to. Is it only people who are required to file but who don't pay a tax, or is it people who earn below that level where they're required to file?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, the way I understand the bill and the on page 5 of the bill in 020, it says an individual required to make a return under the Internal Revenue Code. In other words, if you have to file with the federal government for any reason, if you have a W-2, if you have income, then you also shall file with the department a return. So that says if you file with the IRS, you also have to file a state return. The examples that the chairman provided in yesterday's hearing were a little bit stylized because obviously every family's circumstances are different. Some are going to itemize and all of that, but roughly at around 20,000 or whatever the number is, an individual person is going to have some federal tax liability. If you have some federal tax liability, that calculation is going to govern. If for whatever reason you have a large number of children, you have a lot of deductions, even if you're higher income, if the tax calculation might be bringing you to zero, this bill ensures that that person would at least be paying $25 to the state.
Through the chair. Yeah, what I'm trying to understand is how low is the income that you would go to before you wouldn't have to pay the $25?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, if you are filing taxes, you'd have to pay the $25. So pretty much everyone would have to pay it. And as I understand it, it's $25 per the household, not per the individual person in the household, although the chairman might correct me on that.
Through the chair, I'm still just trying to get a handle on the $25 minimum. I don't really understand the federal rules on who has to file when they don't owe a tax liability. So I'm going to take there are different categories of people. Those people who don't have to file, those people who have to file even though they have no federal tax liability, and then those people who have to file who do have a federal tax liability.
Mr. Chairman, the universe of people who don't have to file at all might be better answerable by Mr. Spanos, who I believe is on the phone. Let's see. Brandon, are you around?
Yes, I'm here.
Through the chair, just to make it shorter. Well,
if you're asking for a particular number, we're going to get it from Mr. Spanos, not from Mr. Alpert. But go ahead, Representative Guerra.
I guess really all I'm trying to find out is who is paying the $25 minimum tax. So everybody or people at a certain income level?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, some fraction of taxpayers file their federal tax and owe zero. That number changes from year to year, and it varies widely from part of the country to part of the country. But for the sake of argument, based on our best available data, we presume that about 25% of the taxpayers in Alaska owe zero federal tax liability for one reason or another, earned income tax credits, number of people in their household, lower income, all of those reasons. So roughly in the modeling for this fiscal note, we presumed about 100,000 taxpayers out of 400,000 households would be at the zero federal rate, which means obviously 15% of zero is zero. Per the statutory rate of 15%, they would owe zero. Instead of that, we would plug in this 25% rate. So those 25%, these roughly 100,000 primarily lower income.
$25 rate,
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. So these 100,000 primarily lower income households would be who would be paying the $25 minimum.
Through the chair.
And follow up and then Representative Wilson.
Yeah. I still am getting confused on filers who don't pay. So let me just give you this example. If you're an adult who has just the permanent fund dividend, that's their only income, so let's say $1,020 last year, would that person under this bill pay the $25 tax?
So through the chair, Representative Garrett, the question I think you're trying to get at is who has to file with the federal government at all? And that is a question that, honestly, I'm not the best person to be answering it, and that's what I'm trying to punt to the deputy director on the phone.
And so, Representative Guerra, if that's a question you want answered, we'll go to Mr. Spanos, are you online?
Yes, I am.
And have you heard the question from Representative Guerra?
Yes, I did. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the federal rules for who has to file, as been stated by a previous testimony, is for a single individual under the age of 65 is $10,300. So that's the gross income. If I make less than $10,300, I don't have a requirement federally to file a return. If I'm an individual and I'm not a dependent and I have a dividend of $1,100, I still wouldn't have a filing requirement because if that's my only form of income, because I'm making less than that $10,300. If I'm a dependent, then I do have a filing requirement if I make over $10,050 of unearned income. So a dependent receiving a dividend of $1,100 would have to file either their own tax return or file usually with their parents. So they're whoever's claiming them as a dependent. Oops. And then for a head of household, someone generally under 65 who's filing a head of household, that's about $13,250. If I make less than that in my gross income, I have no federal filing requirement. And the way HB 115 reads is if there's no federal requirement to file, then I wouldn't have to file. As has been stated previously, a lot of people choose to file because they have withholdings and they're going to get a refund. So even if they make less than $10,000, they may choose to file a return to get a refund. There was no requirement, and therefore, the way that I read HB 115, they wouldn't have to file with the state.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I could just layer one thing on top of that. So if you have an individual with making less than the $10,000 threshold, they might not have to file. Mr. Spanos mentioned one reason they might choose to, because they have withholding, they work part-time, they had some withholding, they want it back. Also, if that person has dependents who might themselves have to file, it might be easier for the whole household to file together. Even if they don't need to because of the individual's income threshold, they might need to because of a child's income threshold because of the PFD.
And just for clarification, as you read the bill, if you're a household and filing as an adult with dependents, because they got PFDs, would each child have to pay the $25, or would it be the filer?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, if for some reason a dependent child was filing an individual return separately, I believe they might individually be susceptible to the $25 tax. If the dependent child were part of a household and the household were filing together, there would be only a single $25 tax.
Okay, thank you. And I forgot Representative Thompson. I had him before Representative Guerra.
Can we finish this discussion?
This on a new subject. If you want to follow on this subject, go back.
Representative Wilson.
So I just want to clarify a couple things. So if I don't have to file by the code, but I decide to file because my income and I have children and I can get earned income back, I'm not subject to the $25 because I don't have to file. I'm choosing to file, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I hadn't thought of that eventuality before, but no, I think you would. But by the act of filing the Alaska tax return, I think you would be triggering the $25 minimum.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
But you just pointed out that it talks about that you have to, if you have to file an income tax return, then you're subject to it. But as you just stated, and Mr. Spanos did too, and they're absolutely correct, under a certain income, I don't have to file a federal income tax. I'm choosing to because I can financially benefit from doing it. So how could Alaska then come back and say you have to pay the $25 when I didn't have to do it, I just chose to?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't have an easy answer. It seems to me if you're choosing to file the federal return, then you're now having to file the Alaskan return. And once you're there, whatever the benefit you got from that refund would have to be reduced by the $25 you owed to the state of Alaska.
And this is a good reason to have committee discussion, because these things all need to be clarified on the record, and we need to make sure that the intention is clear. So I'm noting it so that we make sure that we cover that one way or the other in the discussion and the bill is clear, because if that's not clear, we want to make sure it is. So yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if this bill were to become law, I appreciate what you're doing there. There's a lot of direction and nuance in a complicated bill like this, and we want to make sure as we write the regulations and the forms and so forth that we do what's the intent of the legislature.
And one last thing, Mr. Chairman. So the $25 is based on how many returns the household gives. So if I'm a single person, I'm going to get charged whatever the amount is, or let's just go with the 25. It's just easier than trying to figure out the rest of it. But if I'm a household and let's say my three adult children who haven't decided to get a job yet, lives with me and their kids, and it happens, not mine, Just want to clarify that before, so we put that out in the news. Anyway, my household is only going to get charged because I'm filing as a household, and maybe they're my dependents, even though they made income, $125 charge. I thought that's what you said, is each household was, somebody just said it was only $25 for a married couple or for the filing return. Am I right on that?
I believe that's the way it's written, but we will have to clarify that. That's okay. A great point. I mean, that's what...
No, I'm fine with that. I don't want to... I'm not objecting to it. I just want to understand it.
Great.
Thank you.
And so I guess my staff can come up and answer the question that you have. So we'll bring her up quickly while we're still on the subject.
For the record,
put yourself on the record.
For the record, Tanika Hansen, staff to Representative Seaton. The question about if you had adult children in your house and then filed under one, then could you file under one household and then avoid the minimum tax? The ability for a dependent to file under the household if they have unearned income, which the dividend is, depends on them being under 19. So adult children who are still in your household would be required to file for their dividend.
And, Mr. Chairman, I'm not talking about unearned income at this point. I'm just talking about household itself. No, I understand earned income can only come from a parent who has children in the household based on their income. But I could still have others living in the household making some money but not enough to where they have to file, and they're still my dependent. And the way I, because when I had college students, they were my dependents until they got done with college. And although they had some income, it was underneath where they had to file because they were my dependent. And I'm just trying to make sure then that's a $25 fee. It's not based on how many adults live in the household.
Tanika?
So Representative Wilson, through the chair, again, there is a requirement to file for unearned income, which the dividend is, for a dependent that if the unearned income is over $1,050, then they can be claimed under their parents' return, but only if they're under 19. So an adult living in their parents' house that gets the dividend, my understanding of the tax code is that they would need to file for that dividend. But any child under 19 could be claimed on their parents.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to Representative Thompson.
New subject.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Mr. Alper, I ask a question of Ms. Rodell, and I just wanted to ask you this same question because I still haven't quite got it clear in my mind. In this bill, it doesn't really address anything about volatility of revenue. But I think in the governor's fiscal plan that there is some things that address volatility of revenue. How do you read that? Is there a difference there or not?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson. Yeah, I'll take a crack at this. This bill has a relatively stable, although growing for the long-term modeling, annual draw from the permanent fund earnings towards the general fund as well as another that flows directly to the dividend. The way the governor's bill, the Permanent Fund Protection Act, is structured, it's a slightly higher draw. The 5.25 is the base number, but there's what's known as a clawback feature, where if the oil revenue, the general fund oil revenue from the production tax and the royalty goes above a line, then there's a dollar for dollar pullback of the permanent fund draw equal to the amount of the oil money above that $1.2 billion threshold. What that does is it prevents it protects against the circumstance where there's a big boom in oil money and we still get all this permanent fund money and maybe that could overheat government or cause a run-up of expenditures that might not be sustainable for when the prices go back down. That's the so what that also enables is when you do the long-term modeling, which has some high year lows, years and low years, is you can have a slightly higher annual draw, that 5.25, with the expectation that at some point in the next 20, 25 years, there are going to be a few years where we don't take the full amount because of that volatility provision, and the average draw stays to where it's a sustainable number.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And then we have Representative Pruitt.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a couple questions. One question that's not related to the fiscal notes, and then I actually do have some fiscal note questions. I think you were going to address some of the fiscal note. But this kind of popped up with the earlier discussion. I haven't heard anyone talk about military personnel that live out of the state that reserve a PFD. Are we going to have to be chasing them for $25?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I know certain types of military wages are exempt from the income tax. There's a number of rules unique to service personnel and the federal income tax. One of the weaknesses that I'll openly admit to is we don't have any real expertise on individual income taxes at the Department of Revenue. We haven't had one in 35 years. This is one of the things that we're going to need to learn more about. I would hope that we don't expend a lot of resources chasing after people that live out of state for $25. On the other hand, people that live out of state shouldn't be claiming a dividend.
So, well, and of course, we've allowed the provisions for military personnel who intend on coming back. I mean, that we need to be very clear in how we respect and appreciate the military personnel that live in Alaska and plan on living here. Point is the discussion related to you have in your fiscal note, and that's why this kind of came up, the fiscal note, 100,000 people that are 100,000 taxpayers paying the $25 minimum tax rate. I mean, is that what are we going to need to be able to get at, you know, $25, that's if you're doing a withholding, that's if you're paid twice a month, that's a buck a pay period that would be withheld, that has to be talk about the cost to us in administering that $25 for 100,000 taxpayers. How do you perceive that as the director of the tax division? How do you perceive ensuring that we're receiving those $25? And then what happens if we don't? Do we send people after them? Or, I mean, you have any thoughts on that?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that's a fair question. They're going to have to file because they're filing a federal income tax return. That's the key. If they're not filing, but we're aware of who's filing to the IRS, well, then we have someone who we're going to chase for failure to file or something like that. If they do file but then don't send us the $25, that is something we would have to address. And Mr. Spanos might have a better sense of it. There's a number of small dollar people that owe us in taxes, and yes, that's obviously not the highest priority. Ideally, I don't know if the permanent fund is attachable in that circumstance. My guess is that it probably would be. I'm looking at the chairman for a little bit of insight on this one. But As far as the cost to administer this, there's a lot of paper involved. What we said in the fiscal notice, as many people as possible are going to file electronically, but those who don't, yes, someone's going to have to open the mail and deposit the check and data enter into the computer and all that sort of thing. And the reality of it is it doesn't take any more resources to do that with a $25 check as a $2,500 check. It's still a check. It's still a bunch of data entry.
So, Mr. Chair, continuing on the discussion about the personnel, I mean, last year when we had the discussion when the governor had introduced the bill, that was a flat 6.25. If I remember correctly, there was an estimate from your department of somewhere around 60 people. If I read this fiscal note again, it seems like it's about the same. You still have that same number estimate?
Yeah, through the chair, yes. We're estimating roughly the same additional staff increment to staff up and administer and be prepared to deal with 400,000 income tax returns every year.
So, Mr. Chair, on that point,
Representative Pruitt.
Thank you. So, in looking at though, but this is a different. This is very different. This is not a flat 6.25 of your federal, which is pretty simple. You get the federal income tax returns from the information on those returns. You're able to pair it up. This one has other moving mechanisms connecting to whether or not they paid their they decided to check the box on the permanent fund, whether or not they've paid their $25. Is it still 60 people, or is there also an element of the permanent fund division, not the corporation, but the division that plays into it? And are they going to need additional people? What's it? I mean, it seems like it just seems like being able to do the same thing. The same number of people to do what seems like a little bit more of a burdensome task, that it will probably need more people to be able to make this work.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, there's a couple things there. First off, I'm sitting here as the tax division director. I can only really speak for the tax division. The permanent fund dividend division, I believe, has their own fiscal note. I don't think there's any additional staffing in it from their point of view. It's a form modification. It's a checkbox, and it's a couple more transactions of moving the money from A to B. The math of the 15% tax versus the 6% tax the governor proposed last year, the 10% capital gains tax, the arithmetic isn't really the hard part. The computers do most of that. The biggest burden, frankly, from a staffing point of view, is going to be in the multi-state individual, making sure that the person with income both within and without Alaska is paying the appropriate share of it to the state, and that the underlying complexity of the tax formula is secondary to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, you're welcome, and we are at 3:30, and so I think you're going to we have Tax Division, we have David Teal, we have Commissioner of Revenue, and Brandon on tomorrow. Can you return with the on the fiscal notes?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so. There's a bill in another committee that I don't think I'm going to need to be there for tomorrow, so I should be able to be in your hearing.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate it. And if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we'll be adjourned at 3:33.